Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service, presents Getting Clean, Drug Addiction in Pakistan. The program is produced and presented by Eric Boshima.
We very proudly claim that we've become an opium-growing free country. But is that really something to be proud of? When you have this number on the streets? I mean, 4 million people are directly affected today with drugs in the country. So what are you actually saying?
A group of drug addicts plays music as part of their rehabilitation in the northern Pakistani town of Peshawar. In the late 1970s, Pakistan was producing 800 tons of opium a year. The figure has now dropped to less than 10 tons, but heroin and other drugs have continued to pour into Pakistan from neighboring Afghanistan and other countries. Pakistan's military rulers proclaim their desire to eradicate what they describe as the scourge of drugs, but the number of addicts is increasing, and the authorities are at a loss about how to deal with the problem. As I discovered with Dr. Parveen Azam Khan, the director of DOST, one of the non-governmental organizations trying to deal with Pakistan's growing drug abuse problem, addicts can be found in every layer of society and in the most unusual places, including the cemetery in Peshawar.
They come here because this is the place where they're safe from the police, and also the community would not be too angry with them if they come over here. This is a place where they have some solitude and where generally they can hide behind the graves and the different parts of the cemetery and they can continue with their drug use.
How many drug addicts come here every day?
I would say about 100 come here every day, yes.
So they're taking drugs all day or it's simply a place where they can relax?
They're using drugs all day, and of course between drugs they're sleeping here also on the graves, on the side of the graves, they're all over.
What is your name?
Badr.
Badr. Badr. Okay, Badr, how old are you?
22.
How long have you been taking drugs?
12 years. 12 years.
Why did you start taking drugs?
Peer group, they were taking drugs and also there were no goal in life, aimless life.
But at 10 years old to start taking drugs?
Yeah. Because that is the age, you know, the vulnerable age, the high-risk group. The history starts in the teenage, you know, from hashish, hash, and then they go from softer to harder drugs.
What did you start taking when you started taking drugs?
Charas.
Charas, hashish.
Yeah, hashish.
And how long did you take hashish?
7 years he used hashish, and then he switched over to heroin.
Why did you start with heroin then?
Heroin did you start with?
Heroin was the charas that last started.
Sanga.
Charas was the one.
Okay, he's saying that using hashish, then I wanted to enjoy more and more, you know, for a greater fix. So then he started taking a heroin.
We've come to another site, which is around 2 kilometers from where we were. It's along a very, very busy street, as you can hear in the background. And there are a group of 13 drug addicts. They're sitting in a circle. Most of the men here in the circle are in their late 20s, 30s, 40s. They've probably been taking drugs for 10 years, 20 years.
10, 15 or 20 years. Some of them start at the age of 8 or 10. They start off with maybe taking cannabis and then opium, and then later on they switch over to heroin. Most of these are present heroin abusers.
And why is it that they come to this park? Is it because they're left alone by the police here, and it's the park is a little bit hidden by trees?
Actually, they're all along this, there's a big bus stand over here, and all along the bus stand they have the green belt. And they're all over the green belt, they're in little groups of 3 or 4 persons. They're scattered all over this green belt along this bus stand.
And these men also beg to get their money for the drugs?
Many of them come to a state when they have to beg in between, and that's why they come to the bus stand, because over here there are a lot of passengers and they can get food scraps over here, they can scavenge for food and beg and maybe steal as well. And the drugs, of course, are available over here very easily.
Mohammed Islam is 32. One of his friends introduced him to cannabis when he was 10. 6 years later, another friend gave him a cigarette laced with heroin. Mohammed says he didn't know what he was smoking, but he immediately became hooked. He's been smoking heroin every day for the past 16 years. And like so many other addicts in Pakistan, he desperately wants to quit.
If you can help me today, I'll leave drugs today. I want to leave drugs. He's employed in the railways. He cleans the trains and he gets paid for that.
So do you take drugs in the evening then after work?
He said, whenever I can during my work, I go out and have the drug and then come back and work.
How much do you earn a day?
He said, I get 3,200 rupees as a salary. Besides that, he said, if I can get 50, 60 rupees daily from friends or from somebody else, I use all of it on my drugs.
How much do you spend a day on drugs?
About 150 rupees every day.
So that's around $3 a day.
I'm engaged, he said, but because of my drug taking, they're not giving me the girl in marriage.
Would you like to get married?
Yeah, inshallah, ji. He said, absolutely. He said, by the grace of God, if I leave drugs, then I will be able to get married. He said, I want to leave drugs because my mother is crying all the time. Since 5 nights, I haven't been home at all. I've been here. I have no clean clothes. And he said, I'm fed up of this life now. My mother says prayers for me. She reads the Quran. She goes to holy men just to get me off this addiction. But nothing has worked so far.
In 1980, Pakistan was estimated to have 20,000 heroin addicts. 2 decades later, there are an estimated 3 million addicts. The figures continue to rise, and that doesn't include people who are addicted to prescription drugs, cannabis, cocaine, and other substances. According to the Pakistan Narcotics Control Board, drugs affect the lives of as many as 15 million people. That's 1 in 10 Pakistanis. A wide variety of reasons has been given for the exponential increase in drug addiction, including unemployment, poverty, and illiteracy. But these factors are present in many countries around the world. A far more likely explanation is the widespread availability of cheap drugs. To combat narcotics, Pakistan's military authorities, as well as previous governments, have taken a hardline approach, says Dr. Parveen Khan.
Because drug use is illegal, drug possession is illegal, so a large number of these street addicts land up in the prison. The police keep on making crackdowns every few days, with the result that almost one-third of the prison population are drug addicts, who are mostly users. They're not pushers, they're not smugglers, they're simply drug users, drug addicts. About 4 years ago, when I first went to the Peshawar Central Prison, I wanted to see the condition of the narcotics barracks, where the drug addicts are residents. When I first went there, in one barracks, which was meant for 80 persons, there were about more than 300 drug addicts confined there. And it was just a terrible scenario. I almost started crying.
There are numerous government-run hospitals and psychiatric units in the country that try to help get addicts off drugs. Dr. Hamayoun worked in one of these units 15 years ago. Conditions, he says, have hardly changed since then.
They used to have 12 beds there, a long waiting list of clients who wanted to be admitted there because it was quite cheap. In the treatment, they were giving medication for detoxification for 7-8 days. Then, because of their pressure of clients and rush, there was a tendency to make the bed free for the next client. So they were even not fully detoxed when they were discharged, and they were given some tranquilizer prescriptions and they were told to come back for follow-up, which they never do. Detoxification was pretty rough. There was a lot of physical agony there, I have seen.
What type of physical agony?
The withdrawal symptoms were very severe there, which I have noticed after working in other environments. Maybe the environment was not very caring and supportive.
So there was a very high failure rate?
Yes, it has very high failure rate, and still it is. Now even clients who cannot afford, they usually avoid going to government hospitals because that thing doesn't work. When you tell them, why don't you go to mental hospital or government unit, they say it's not good there.
In disgust at the failure of the government's detoxification and rehabilitation program, Dr. Hamayoun joined Niazindigi, which means a new life, a non-governmental organization or NGO trying to help Pakistan's drug addicts lead productive lives again. The founder is Tariq Safa. Like 80% of his staff, Tariq is a former addict. He eventually went to England to kick his habit.
Basically, my whole idea initially was to have a sort of a group of ex-users along with me so I could relate to, because that is what was emphasized when I was in treatment in England by the treatment staff. So for me, the best option was to go around to treatment centers and say, okay, I want to know where your ex-users are and, you know, I'm an ex-user. And going around to the best ones in the country, I found out they had no clue what they were doing. So that's why I said, okay, I need to have it for myself. I mean, I still look at it that I want to be the client who's got the maximum out of this center even today.
Outside the old fort in Lahore, social workers walk around a small park where addicts come to get their fix. There are about 40 addicts, all men or boys, sitting or lying down on the grass and benches. Street doctors, as they're known, are attending to some of them, searching for veins to inject the heroin. Just across the street is the red light district. Ahmed Bakhshawan, one of Niazindigi's social workers, told me that the desperation is so great here that addicts play on the feelings of passers-by and the Muslims' obligation to give alms by using the bodies of addicts to beg.
They are many times beg on the dead body of injecting drug users for hours and hours, and after collecting the handsome amount from the general community, they arrange some arrangements for bury, to bury that dead body in the graveyard.
But the money that they're begging, they're actually using it for their own habit. Yeah, they're not using it to bury the person.
Yeah, yeah. It is just for his their drug use.
What also struck me in the park was that there were many children who were playing there in the park. Obviously, if you've got people who are injecting drugs, there are syringes and needles that are lying on the ground, and these children could be infected themselves.
We are educating the registered people which are in our services enrolled now that don't throw the needles and the ampules, empty ampules in the park. We have printed many posters which are showing that any child, any person in the park is at a high risk due to their used needles and used glasses, ampules, which they are used to throw into the parks without any safety measures.
The conditions in areas like this are ideal for the spread of a wide variety of diseases, including HIV, as a study which Niazindigi carried out on behalf of the United Nations highlighted.
The result was quite horrifying in the sense that 89% were hepatitis C positive. Whereas they say in the general community, I think it's between 7 to 10%. Now, there's a lot of needle sharing going on, which is like 65%. So logically, if there is HIV in the pool, it will spread. What happens is that in that marginalized community, there's a lot of cross-fertilization. For example, they use the same people who treat abscesses. We've got street doctors who just kind of give you a cut with the same sharp knife that is going to cut somebody else. So that exchange is also there. There were other indicators which are also quite alarming. Majority of them are sexually active. Use of condoms is negligible. 3% claim they always use condoms. Yeah. So if HIV gets there, it's going to get there. 13% are commercial blood donors. So you can imagine it's like a time bomb. Yeah. Over 95% of the clients that we have come from very low income or poverty backgrounds. So first step is to reach them out. Now, reaching out is not saying, hey, we provide drug services, come here. No, we say, look, we understand you want to use, we understand this is your need of the day, but you know, you can use and be without this abscess on your arm. Let's treat your abscess. So the doctor starts treating abscess. This is all free of cost. Abscess is treated, he's got some skin eczema, or whatever medical needs there are. At the same time, we try and explain to them, do not share needles, or don't go from heroin smoking to injecting. If you go, then don't share needles. And if required, they're provided needles and syringes, those who are injecting. And at the same time, we're providing them information about drug services. And we don't say, you know, go for detox, that's the best thing. No. They themselves come to a point in time where something has happened. It's either the police is after them, or they can't use anymore, their health doesn't permit them, they're scared. The person who was injecting them dies, you know, the street doctor. So they want to come for detox. So then they move into detox. Now, this process of decision-making can vary from, I would say, 4 weeks to 6 months. So our job as outreach workers is just to be present there, full stop.
The Dost Welfare Foundation in the northern border town of Peshawar takes a similar approach. It has teams of social workers who regularly visit areas in the town where drug addicts congregate. The addicts can obtain basic medical services, counseling, and they're given information about issues such as HIV and AIDS, hepatitis, nutrition, personal hygiene, and the safer use of drugs. They're also invited to attend a drop-in center where they can bathe, wash their clothes, and relax. 16-year-old Azghar began attending the drop-in center a little over 2 weeks ago.
He's saying that his father was a drug addict and he was also a drug seller. So that's why I had that culture in my home, drug culture.
So when you were 13, you started taking drugs. What type of drugs did you take in the beginning?
At the age of 11, he's saying that I started taking cannabis and alcohol. The local alcohol. And then I switched over to heroin, you know.
Why did you decide to come to Dost?
He's saying that I have no money and from here I can get admission free, and my father is also addicted and I have two sisters and three brothers. So now I decided to quit. You know, I want to help my family because they are in bad shape. I just reduced the daily dose. Previously, I used to take 1.5 to 2 grams in 24 hours. And now I just reduced to 1 gram and sometimes half a gram.
The Dost Detoxification and Rehabilitation Center is half an hour away from Peshawar. Most of the men you hear here have been in the center for several weeks. 28-year-old Abdullah arrived only yesterday. He's trying to kick a 14-year heroin addiction.
He said, my whole family is very upset with me, my wife, my children, my mother and my father, they don't want to have anything to do with me. So I want to leave drugs so that I can have a normal life again.
You arrived here yesterday afternoon. How do you feel now?
He said that the tablets the doctor has given me, I'm feeling better with those.
Is this the first time that you actually try to quit drugs?
He said, I've tried many home treatments, and in my village the doctors have been treating me, but I haven't been to a hospital before this.
Do you think it's going to succeed this time?
By the grace of God, I will succeed this time.
The civil ward? Administration last کړه چې هغه یو کیچن سپروایزر کې خلاف ورزی کوي د اصولو زاغه ته احساس دلاوم.
The detoxification lasts for 15 days and is followed by a 2-month rehabilitation program. During this time, the addicts attend group sessions like this one, lectures and other activities designed to change their behavior. Tahir arrived here nearly a month ago.
I came here for 15 days. to get rid of my habit. But when I heard their seminar, the RPP, Relapse Prevention Program, I told my counselor to please give me some more time up here so I could learn, because it has been 13 years. I'm trying to give it up. I can't. So he said, long as you want to stay here for how long, it's fine with me. It is almost a month now since I've been here. It's a good place over here. I have seen lots of places. But this one, it's something different. Up here, they teach you in the hard way. And that's the way I like it, because in a softer way, I don't think I would understand it, you know. I didn't understand it because so many places that I've been through and it didn't work. And I hope this one will work.
Do you feel like when you leave here that you will be tempted again by drugs?
I pray to God, no. I'm going to keep contact with them. And if I can, I would spend most of the time up here, you know.
How do you see life post-dust? What do you plan to do?
I'm going to pick it up piece by piece, you know, little by little. Try to hang on to what I had over here, you know.
Do you feel like you have the courage and the energy to take it step by step?
I do, but I need help mentally, which I'm getting it over here, you know.
Good luck.
Thank you.
The second phase of rehabilitation is trying to reintegrate drug addicts in society, and that also means getting them back on their feet economically, says Tarek.
Classically, you'll see with NGOs, you know, they'll go into poultry farms. Even if it's profitable or even if it's sustainable economically, it's a very non-interesting, non-challenging job for an ex-user. He needs more spice in it, more innovation, more where his capacity is not limited but is challenged constantly. And that's what we found out that was the key skill. We were funded by the European Commission to set up a project to provide socio-economic rehab. Yeah, and as part of that, we were asked to do a motor workshop. Now, a motor workshop, again, is quite boring. You know, you've done an engine once, you've done an engine once. We changed the project to rebuilding vintage Jeeps. So what we did was we took World War II Jeeps from the army, which were kind of totally put off track because they'd been over a landmine or, you know, an accident or something. And we put them back on track. Moreover, the whole concept of being back on track when a boy is working, you know, he's been off track, say, for 10 years on the streets. While he's putting the Jeep back on track, he himself is getting back on track.
My name is Tasveer Hussain. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I have been sober since 1991, and I look after the Project Jeep Rebuild. The idea was to start something which was able to generate enough income to take care of itself, the expenses, and also take care of the fact that people who are through with their treatment at the treatment center can be employed and taught vocational skills.
What exactly do you do?
We get applications from the boys who have completed their treatment in the center. After making an appraisal, some of them are invited to join us as apprentices. And then they are, according to their capabilities and according to their aptitude, fitted in different departments. There are four basic departments here: the mechanical section, the body repair section, the paint section, and the electric section.
This is a fairly novel type of approach, isn't it? I mean, rebuilding old Jeeps as a means to get former drug addicts onto the job market.
If they are able to learn the skills acquired in rebuilding Jeeps, this will be something in which they have a lot of chance to progress, because rebuilding Jeeps is not the only thing that they're learning. They're learning to rebuild all vehicles. Later on, they can transfer this knowledge to other makes and models also.
Recovering addicts can choose other vocations too. Nia Zindigi has workshops, for example, for furniture production, metalwork, paint, tile making, and so forth.
What we believe is that once you have been part of a drug subculture, yeah, which has its different norms, it has its different value systems, and you've lived a life which is quite marginalized compared to the rest of the community, you come into a classic detox center or a rehab center, and most of the rehab centers and the staff expect you to go out, stay clean, and move on as a classic client who's been through rehab, totally changed and all that. Reality is quite different. In reality, life probably becomes tougher once you get off drugs, especially when scoring is easy, especially when price is not very high. What we believe is that we need to create what we call a positive subculture for a certain period of time after rehab, so that the person who's gone through rehab can gradually adjust between this positive subculture that understands him, give him confidence, improve his socio-economic status, and then gradually move in.
Since Nia Zindigi started in 1990, it's achieved remarkable success. Nearly half of those who've gone through Nia Zindigi's detoxification and rehabilitation programs are still drugs-free 2 years later. For those who go on to do vocational training, the figure is even higher, 80%. Dost has achieved similar results. Both organizations believe that their programs are not only successful, they're also cost-effective. But they're facing increasing problems getting funding as a result of the military coup in 1999 and growing concern, particularly in the United States, about Pakistan's acquisition of nuclear missiles from China and North Korea. According to Tarek Zafa, organizations like his are now even finding it difficult to get funds for clean needles and syringes.
It's like a punishment which eventually is going to land up in your lap in the West. Because the tougher the conditions get here, more bored people you're going to have on that end. And more bored people with health problems. So, I mean, on one side we're talking about this, you know, one world and all this jazz. How much of it is true? If you're educated, if you know what is happening on ground, and you don't have a hidden agenda, you won't stop that aid. You want to stop military missiles, that's your business, that's between you. But we're talking of syringes and needles, which are not missiles. They might look like one, but they're not actually missiles. So I think it's unreasonable.
Pakistan finds itself at a crossroads. Growing economic problems, political paralysis, and rising fundamentalism are holding the country in their grip. And drug addiction is continuing to rise, though the growth rate may finally be slowing. In the year 2000, the Taliban authorities in neighboring Afghanistan issued an edict prohibiting opium poppies. The ban has led to a steep rise in the price of heroin, but Tarek Zafa fears that that alone will not solve Pakistan's enormous drug problem.
Reality of life here is getting quite bad, has got bad, is going to get more. So you've got an increasing number of people wanting to escape. Can you imagine the price going up, crime going up? What do you have in the West? The price went up, your law enforcement was more effective, you've got more crime related to drugs. You do that here, you think people are going to stop using? No, crime is going to grow up, you're going to have more organized crime.
Getting Clean was produced and presented by Eric Boshima. Technical production, Alex Van Horn. The music was performed by recovering addicts at the Dost Welfare Foundation. This has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.